I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I'm your host, Gary Levitt. This week I talk to screenwriter and actor, Mr. Patrick Devanny. We talk about his writing and his creative process. We talk about him beating alcoholism, depression, self-medication, all that fun stuff. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a musician, a podcaster, a voiceover artist, go to the App Store and search for Future Moments, because they probably have an app that'll make your life simple. Have a look at the show notes for links to the guest and how you can leave a review, because we like that. And most of all, hope you enjoy. Drinking of the water.
Yes.
All right. Patrick Devanny, you have a very impressive resume. It's quite long. You've been a musician.
Yes.
You've been a sculptor and a painter.
True.
And now you are an actor and a screenwriter with over 30 screenplays?
Just over.
Okay. So I want to start with a broad question.
Sure.
All these creative outputs, which satisfies you the most?
I would have to say at the very... Lately, it's been completing a really good performance as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing that I've really started to focus in on most.
Does it matter if they're your lines or anyone else's?
No, not at all. I actually prefer someone else's.
Why is that?
Because I have a hard time, if I'm doing my own work, not being me. It's mm-hmm. hard. If I'm writing, sometimes I'm writing in my own voice,
right,
and that's kind of difficult to do. But if it's somebody else's, then I can really try to interpret what they were saying, and that makes it more fun for me.
Is there a sort of freedom, like similar to a lot of musicians say, it's easier to sing someone else's song than your own because there's just less baggage that comes with that?
I think so. I think there's a good point in that. I think that my own stuff, it's easier to say because I've read it so many times in my head
mm-hmm.
and in front of me.
Yeah.
But the more joy I get out of it is from doing someone else's work and them saying, "Well, listen, you really got it."
You know?
And that's a big rush.
Yeah.
You know, for me. On the production end, though, I think that overall, when that final edit comes in, because I always edit my own work.
Right.
When that finally comes in and you can see that final, I liken it to sculpting. It's like that final sculpt, that mold of the film that you want to make. Once you see that and you know it's done,
right,
it's wonderful. I had an art teacher that taught me a very valuable lesson. He said, listen, my painting teacher in college. He said, there's no such thing as a finished painting. The painter just decides when he's going to stop painting. But they're never done.
And that's the hardest thing to know is when to stop.
Right, exactly. And you have to look at it and say, okay, this may never be done. A song may never be finished. It's always one thing more you can do in production, but you have to decide when to put the brush down.
Yeah. Do you have that problem writing screenplays?
That's a little bit easier. I can know when a story is done.
Yeah.
I think that there's always room to go back and add certain things. I have multiple revisions of a lot of scripts. If I don't have them done, I like to go back after a while and redo them. Mm-hmm. I have a feature script out right now. It's had 7 revisions. I started writing this thing 7 years ago.
Yeah,
and now it's bouncing around in the festivals, which is really good.
Right.
But I can't afford to produce it because I need about $300,000 for it. But going back and making little revisions and little things, and you know. But if it was set in stone, if someone wanted to produce it, then it's done.
That is the tricky thing with films. You write a great screenplay, then you got to get all the actors. It's such a grand production that costs so much money to even produce, even on a low budget. If you have a lot of actors, is that frustrating? Because as a stand-up, it's like if I think of a joke or a bit, I can go try it that night and get my immediate gratification. Where if you write a screenplay, when do you get that gratification? When you're done with the screenplay? When you've seen it on screen?
It all depends. When I finally see people doing the lines, I finally see like maybe like the first read through on the script, the first rehearsal for that.
Yeah,
that's always a rush because seeing them doing that is just amazing.
Do you sometimes like great screenplay is good? I don't need to produce it.
Oh yeah. I've done that. I mean, the one that I have out right now, the feature, someone's already spoken to me about, you know, we may have someone looking at it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, great, run with it.
Yeah.
And if I can play a part in it, that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, I just found out that a short film that I wrote, a friend of mine came to me with a story and said, you know, I have this idea, but I'm not really a writer. What do you think about it? And this was a couple of months before I wrote my film Impervia. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it out for him. He loved it, and I gave it to him. And this was years ago. And I just recently found out there may be someone interested in producing it.
Super cool.
And it's great. I mean, I never thought that anything would come of it. I just did it really for a friend of mine, who had helped me in the past. And he's saying, "Listen, we may have someone doing this." And I was like, "Great." And he goes, "I want to clear it with you first." I'm like, "Listen, if you can get it done, run with it. Give me writer's credit, and yeah. If I could play one of the parts, that's great. But if you can do it, awesome, do it, knock it out."
That sounds like an interesting creative project, to take someone's story or even a book and make a screenplay out of it, kind of break it down into characters. And I imagine you're changing the medium of it a little bit. So,
Somewhat. I just had an experience with this. We're filming a new film in November called Identity Check. Mm-hmm. And it's a film about either an alternate world or a future world where who you are as a person, your entire identity, can be bought and sold like any other commodity.
Cool.
And the film takes place in a very high stakes match between these two multi-billionaires, one of whom is buying all of the identities of another. And it's going to be really, really fantastic when they do it. I got the best cast in the world for this thing.
This sounds like perfect for now, because identity theft, and it's also a bit of like a Black Mirror sci-fi kind of thing I'm getting.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so tricky because you write something that's inspired by the cultural now, perhaps. Like you're like inspired by what's going on, and then you write it. But by the time you finish writing it, get the actors, you film it, you get all the post-production done, it could be years.
It really could. I was scheduled to do a different film this November, mm-hmm. and it was this bizarre genetic nightmare world. And when I really looked at what I had the location for it, I had the people, I had the crew. I just didn't have the funding to do it properly. I could do it, but it would be a much watered down version of it, and I didn't want to do that because the story's too cool. So it's funny, the origin of this one. I was actually on my way to perform a wedding for my creative partner, Lauren Lazetis, right? Who's now Lauren Biazzi.
What do you mean perform a wedding?
I'm a licensed minister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I was actually going to marry her to her now husband.
Okay.
And on the way there, my wife Gina had said to me, you know, I had this crazy dream. I went to my doctor and it was somebody else, but he called himself by the doctor's name. And I said, well, who are you? And he says, oh, I bought his practice and I also bought his personality. And we were on the way to the wedding, and I was like, wow, that's fantastic. I'm like, that would make a great movie. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking about the story. as I'm going over the lines for the wedding and I'm waiting for the bride to arrive, I went into the men's room. When I came out, the entire script blasted into my head.
Wow.
And I went, oh, there it is. And I went outside and I told my wife, I said, listen, that dream you had, I think I have the entire script. Like, it's just sitting in my skull, but I can't talk about it now because we got to do this wedding.
Yeah. And, so of course you left the wedding to go write, and they're still unmarried.
Did. Yeah. And Lauren hasn't spoken to me since. But, yeah. So listen, you guys get out of here. No, it was great. And when I told her about it later on, I'm like, listen, you know, you're never going to believe what I did at your wedding. She had a good laugh about it. And I offered her one of the leading roles and she took it like that. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah. So she's going to be playing, you know, one of the attorneys arguing the settlement on, you know, who can buy who.
And your wife gets co-writing credit.
Absolutely does. Actually, original story by Gene Alvarez. So
cool. So I want to dive into your history because I sense from your intensity that there is a lot of history behind you.
Yeah, there's a bit.
Yeah, all right. It says in your bio that you played music in the 80s. You're a musician.
Yeah, I was a keyboardist and a bass player from the early 80s on. Mm-hmm. I had my first band in 1981.
Yeah.
And I've been playing, I was playing for most of the 80s performing live.
But I caught that you studied painting in college.
I did study painting in college for a while.
Yeah.
After my music career kind of died out by the end of the 80s.
Oh, you went back to college.
I went back to school in 1990.
Okay.
And I spent the next 5.5 years there.
Okay.
Getting a degree in cultural anthropology, which really helps filmmaking so much.
It's not even really that practical, is it?
No, it's not in the least, but yeah. It's a fascinating thing, and I was thinking maybe going on to teaching, but that mm-hmm. never materialized.
So coming out of high school, you wanted to be a musician?
Oh, coming out of high school is all I wanted. All I was doing was playing in bands. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even thinking about going to college. Queens College accepted me. Mm-hmm. So just to make my mom happy, pretty much, I said, okay, well, she really wanted me to go to school, so I figured I'd give it a year, and I went. But I was constantly playing in bands.
So you're born and raised in New York?
I was born on 77th Street in Manhattan in the late 60s, and I've been here ever since. Mm-hmm. I've lived somewhere in New York City ever since, and now I'm on the actual literal physical legal limit of New York City before it becomes Long Island.
You don't really have that New York accent.
I try not to do it too much, but you know.
It's there.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely there. But yeah, I try not to do it too much, but because it comes across so strongly.
Yeah.
You know, so I try to like keep it back a little bit. But
now I sense that you have a taste of the road life as a musician.
I do. Not so much for my own career, but in the early 90s, a friend of mine who was one of the like most renowned roadies in the country, he was like, listen, we need some spots on this tour for the Smithereens. He's like, why don't you come and do this? So I became their bass tech for almost 2 years.
You're the Smithereens bass tech?
Yes.
And you're just touring with them. How long were the tours?
It was, they were recording an album called A Date with the Smithereens, and they were doing one-off shows. So there would be a show in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then there'd be two shows in Mississippi, and then a week would go by or 2 weeks go by, and then there'd be a show in New Jersey. So I was in school at the time. Uh-huh. So when I wasn't in school, I was bouncing around, you know, the country with this amazing rock band.
Yeah. How did you manage going to classes and then just having a fly?
It was difficult. I missed a lot of classes because we would drive the U-Hauls everywhere.
Right.
So, but it was funny. Like
oh, right. The band probably flew, but you had to drive.
Oh yeah. The roadies are with the crew. The roadies with the equipment and the crew.
Yeah.
You know, in the rear with the gear. So that's what we would do, and we would drive literally all over the country just doing this. And my friend Kevin, who's sadly no longer with us, he's an amazing roadie. I mean, he was a roadie for the Sugar Cubes when they were touring with U2, and he knew everybody. Mm-hmm. You know. So and that was where he was mainly with the Smithereens and with King Diamond. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah.
I think people talk about the rock star lifestyle and on the road and all the drug use, drinking and partying that goes on.
Yep.
But it's rarely talked about that. That's kind of also happening with the roadies.
Constantly. you can't do too much because you do have to be up really early and you are carrying heavy equipment and you're doing a lot of stuff. But to give you an example, I mean, we pulled into Jackson, Mississippi, mm-hmm. and we immediately hit the bar in the hotel. And we started talking to the barmaid, and her friend was the concierge, and they couldn't meet the band, so they all took us out. Uh-huh. And they brought us to house parties all over Jackson. We saw the, you know, the governor's mansion and, you know, all this crazy stuff. But we wound up in these house parties, and all of a sudden it's 2 a.m. and I'm like, you know, we have to unload, you know, in 4 hours.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, you know, a lot of women are just happy to meet, you know, guys from the band, even if you're not in the band.
Right.
I mean, those stories are true, and it's a lot of fun. You know, yeah. And I was 24 years old at the time, so I was having a hell of a good time.
So you're drinking, you're partying.
A lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
Would you say you're out of control?
I would say that that in general, my drinking was out of control and my partying was out of control until maybe about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
But at that time, I couldn't imagine going anywhere without booze and doing that kind of stuff. But the actual sets themselves were always dry. Like, there was no drug use whatsoever. There was one guy that came on the crew with us who got high before tune-up, mm-hmm. and we put him on a van, we sent him his ass home, and that was it.
Why was that order of the band?
I don't know if it was order of the band. It was the order of my friend Kevin, who was the road manager. Mm-hmm. And he was like, listen, we can do whatever we want, but when we are carrying equipment, when we are doing this, we are straight. And I learned that, and that's why I run straight sets now, mm-hmm. like on my film sets. It's completely dry. People, we can all go out and hang out afterwards, but mm-hmm. you know, and there are people that say, listen, even going for like lunch, don't have a beer.
Right.
If you drink and don't come back.
Right. You it's mentioned as simple as that. Your roadie friend that got you the job.
Right.
You mentioned that he's no longer with us.
He's been gone about 11 years ago, about 11, almost. Damn, almost 12 years now.
Casualty of the road?
He was actually, his personality started getting strange, and we started getting a little bit distant. He got a little distant from his wife, and he was on tour with Moby mm-hmm. in Australia, mm-hmm. and he just collapsed backstage, and it turned out that he had a series of brain tumors that had been growing for years, and none of us knew.
And that's what was changing his personality.
That's what changed his personality and making him, you know, someone that was not him. And we knew there was something wrong, but we just didn't know what it was.
Right.
And they were inoperable. And within 2 weeks, he was gone.
Oh, wow.
You know, a wonderful guy, one of my best friends in the world, and taught me a lot. He was 10 years older than me, too. So he taught me a lot of the things he told me that were going to come in my life, they all came true. He's like, you're going to see 10 years from now, this is going to happen. And he was dead serious.
And no one caught the growing tumors.
Mm. No one had any idea. It happened so fast. And no one understood. You know, he was always a strange guy. He was the best artist I've ever met in my life, like graphic artist, physical, mm-hmm. and as far as sculpting and painting, that kind of medium, best I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
And he's just an all-around wonderful guy. And when he wasn't managing art galleries, he was on the road with Motorhead, you know? So it's...
I think that's a growing study, the tumors in the brain. And there's, you know, they say like a lot of pedophiles, they just have a tumor in the brain and then you could take them out. You could basically change people's personality. I think they're practicing with prisoners where you can...
Yeah,
I could stick my thumb inside your brain and turn you into a different person.
I think there's a lot to that. I think that the road to get to where, how to do that is pretty scary. And then what do people want to erase from other people? It's like, ugh.
Yeah, you know? this is a sci-fi situation.
Yeah,
right there.
Yeah. I mean, it happens. I mean, there are times when people have tumors and you know, a very, very, very good friend of mine just went through this. He had a tumor growing in his head for 10 years and no one knew. His personality just became more and more bizarre. Mm-hmm. And it was benign. It was just an active whatever. He finally collapsed and they saved his life, you know, and he's around today and he's recovering. He's doing a wonderful job.
Is he back to how he was 10 years ago?
He's incredibly close. He's really, really back and he's doing fantastic. Actually, he's really doing good considering that, you know, we weren't sure if he was going to make it or not.
I wonder if that ever happens where someone has a tumor and then they take it out and it turns out like the tumor was the reason the person was a nice guy. And they take the tumor out and the guy's just a jerk.
It can absolutely happen. I kind of go through that. Not to keep getting morbid, you know, and then this one died. But my mom has been having tiny strokes going back to the early 90s, and we had no idea. Mm-hmm. Her heart goes into AFib and it creates all these things, but she can't feel it. And it's created dementia in her.
What is AFib?
AFib fibrillation in her heart. From what I understand, the blood flow alternates in the heart, mm-hmm. and can actually pool blood in the bottom ventricles of the heart, and that can congeal. And when it goes back to normal, it sends these little blood clots flying through the system. And people have this. And most of the time, most people can feel it, you know, but she can't feel it. So we had no idea what was going on with her. But it's the multiple strokes and all this issues, it's actually made her a happier person. She's, you know, a lot of the bad memories she's had, she's forgotten a lot of these things.
Huh.
And it really is amazing. I mean, I just saw her before I came here. So it's, you know, and she's going to the senior center. They're going out playing dominoes and things. And she's happy and she's smiling and she sees me. And that's not how it was when we were growing up. So
yeah.
It's actually, like what you said, it's actually kind of made her a little bit different, you know, better person.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Not, I don't want to say better, a happier person.
It's part of that because she's just more grateful to be alive.
I honestly don't know. It's hard to track what she's thinking and what she's feeling.
Right.
But she just seems more accepting, more happy. She was never really a judgmental person, but there's no judging at all in her. She's just happy to be, you know, going through from one day to the next, and she, you know, goes to her center and she hangs out, and her aide comes, and then she sees me, and you know, it's that kind of thing. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting watching that process.
Yeah.
You know, as long as she's happy and she's not, you know, in any pain, and like I'm good with it, you know.
We're all gonna be there.
Probably.
If we're lucky, right?
Yeah. If we're lucky and we can, as long as everything is working, you know, I don't mind being, you know, 100 years old. If I can still think about that, knowing that I'm 100 years old,
right.
You know, other than that, give me another 10, 15 years and I'm good.
Yeah. You know, the quality of life is definitely a big factor, I'd say.
Hell yeah.
Speaking of quality of life. So you're touring all over the place.
Yes.
And, you're drinking every day.
I'm drinking a lot. I spent most of 1986 into 1988 pretty much drunk every day.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
A variety of things. Yeah. Anything short of pretty much shooting heroin was game.
Yeah.
I never really did that, but and like you know, I mentioned my friend before. You know, he was they were giving him crack when they called it rock, and he didn't even know what it was.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was hanging out at CB smoking this, and he's like, "Wait a minute, this is that crack stuff? Wait a minute, I don't want that." So I go back with that stuff, but not too heavy in things. Some things I knew that I really liked a lot. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I couldn't go near them often, you know. Cocaine was a wonderful feeling.
Yeah.
A far too nice a thing for me to ever want to be regularly doing this.
Especially, you know, for a drinker, because you could do a bunch of coke and then not even feel your alcohol, so you can keep drinking.
Oh, yeah. And that happens, you know. I mean, I would go, one of my good friends in this life who unfortunately did succumb to this, my buddy Chris File. I used to go to after hours with him all the time, and we used to, I mean, it was 11 o'clock in the morning. We'd find our way back. It was a great story one night, because he would do a lot of blow, and he wouldn't, if he was still with us, he wouldn't care if I told the story, because everyone knew, and he did it in front of everybody. He was a 400-pound biker. He didn't give a shit about anything.
That sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But a brilliant guy, an instructor at the French Culinary Institute. I mean, he was this, you know, all these dichotomies, all these guys have these amazing, like you know, straight jobs, and then they're just like these absolute lunatics, but also nice people, you know. It's like I wouldn't spend my time with someone who was nasty, you know. Just he was out of his mind, but a funny son of a bitch. And he brought me down to this after hours by JFK Airport, and it was a Saturday night, and the normal bar we were at closed at 4, and we wound up in this place, and it had to be 10:30, 11 in the morning, and we're falling out of this place. He had already done an 8-ball by himself, and I was still drinking whiskey at 9 a.m. and we fall out of this little door of this hidden after hours illegal bar, and there's an entire family in front of us going to church.
Uh-huh.
And we look at them, and they look at us, and they have this little old grandmother with her gigantic Easter hat on, right? And she looks at us, and she says, it turns to her grandson, and she says, "You see, now that's the devil." and we were like, "Yes, ma'am." You know, I couldn't even argue it. And the whole family just nodded at the grandma, and they looked at us, and they walked away.
Uh-huh.
I said to my friend, I'm like, "This is messed up." He goes, "Yeah, she's not even wrong, though." I said, "No, she's not. She nailed us, man."
But at that moment, were you guys experiencing a lot of joy, or were you just like, "Oh, man, what are we doing?"
At that point, we looked back at it years later and laughed about it. But at that point, I was just like, yeah, grandma's right. Uh-huh. Like, we have to go home and reexamine our lives. Mm-hmm. So, and that was when I kind of knew, like, this is a problem. You know, this uh-huh. is a problem. But I mean, this was also like early 2000s. Mm-hmm. You know, that I never addressed any of this issue.
You know? So you were drinking for decades.
I started drinking in the 8th grade. I started drinking in 1982. Mm-hmm. And I've almost drank myself to death twice.
How do you drink yourself to death? What happened?
You drink constantly and an enormous amount of hard liquor, mm-hmm. and then either pass out on your back or pass out by train tracks or something like that. For my 23rd birthday, my friends wanted a reason to drink, and I was just like, well, I'm turned 23 today. And they were like, no, you didn't. So I sold my license, and they were like, oh, shit, you didn't.
That's a great reason.
It's a great reason.
So it was meant to be.
Exactly. We wanted to get high, and here's the reason. And they bought me a bottle of Southern Comfort that I drank pretty much on my own.
Oh.
And I couldn't possibly sober up. I just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And
would you black out?
I was trying to black out and I couldn't, and I was crazy and I couldn't sober up. And by the time I got back to my house, I couldn't sober up and I was starting to freak out. Mm-hmm. So I took a kitchen knife and I stabbed myself in the arm right there.
Oh, you have a scar on your forearm.
Yeah. That's my 23rd birthday scar. Yeah. I just stabbed myself almost to the bone. And then I freaked out because I'm bleeding everywhere. And I said, oh, okay, I better start calling people. So I called the biker guy that I just mentioned. And I called my buddy Joe Stephen Case. And I called a bunch of other guys. And Joe met me. And what he did was he brought me to the local bar where they said, oh, it's your birthday. Here, have another drink. And, uh-huh. and our friend Norbert took a first aid kit and patched me up as best he could.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't going to go to the hospital. And
when you stabbed yourself in the arm.
It sobered me up instantly.
It did, right?
For maybe about a minute uh-huh. or two, and then I started going back into it. But I guess it was adrenaline or endorphins or whatever mm-hmm. it works. But whatever that was, it was like, yeah, that's what we got to do. You know, that makes sense to me now. Right. You know?
Just keep stabbing myself.
Yeah, if I just keep stabbing myself, that time I get home, you know I'll leave home, get to the bar, come back, keep stabbing myself. So that was my
shot, stab, yeah. Shot, stab. Yeah.
Stab, 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 stab. So that was a lot of fun, and my poor buddy Chris, he lived in Long Beach. He speeding all the way up here in the friggin', you know, state. He's caught him and uh-huh. gave him a ticket for speeding, trying to find my dumbass. And even then it was like, yeah, this is business as usual. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was smoking 2.5 packs of cigarettes a day. I was coughing up blood, thinking this is perfectly normal.
Uh-huh. What were you pursuing? Mm-hmm. Were you pursuing a career in anything, or you just?
I wasn't pursuing a damn thing except in my mind. I was still going to be this famous rock musician. Mm-hmm. I was still going to get there. I was just waiting for the right act. You know, because bands had always shown up for me. They'd always shown up. But a lot of those guys either became, you know, studio guys, or they became touring musicians, or they gave it up.
Right.
So the bands that were always forming stopped forming. Mm. And I sat for my 20s and I pretty much waited for the next band to show up, and it never showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of my 20s, I was like, well, what am I doing? What the hell am I doing waiting on this? You know,
this is what year, end of your 20s?
End of the 20s, so it would be late 90s, so like 98.
Okay, so 90. The music industry is still pretty healthy.
The music industry is pretty still healthy. When I was at the height of my career, is mm-hmm. a great, you'll love this. When I was at the height of my career, it was mid 1987. Uh-huh. We were playing CBGBs, we were playing Bitter End, Bottom Line, playing every major place in New York except the Garden and Radio City.
Yeah.
We played everywhere, and it was wonderful. We had scheduled a gig at a Prince's Club out in Minneapolis, and there, all these things were going to happen, and it was wonderful. Going to Star Search, they wanted us, and I was like, this is great.
Right.
We were turning down independent record offers. This is how like good this was.
Yeah.
And our producer came to us, and he was ex-Army, and he was stationed in, he's from Seattle, and he came to us, and he goes, listen, guys, I have an idea. What we need to do is bring everybody out to Seattle, because there's a music scene brewing there that mm-hmm. you guys, it's going to take over the world. And we all fell on the floor laughing.
Oh no, this is right before grunge.
This is like May of 87.
Oh no.
And we laughed in his face to the point where like the guy stopped working with us. Like we couldn't believe how funny that sounded. We were like, what are we going to do? Play to cows in the rain? Like, what are we going to do?
Right, right.
And then like all of a sudden I hear this album by a band called Soundgarden. And I'm like, what is this? And
yeah.
By 91, I mean, you know what happened.
Yeah.
So we always think about every now and then I see that guy online. I'm just like, hey, what's up? You were right.
Ah, he was really right.
But he actually wants to bring us out there and make us part of that scene, mm-hmm. you know? And we were a funk band. So it's like, it was kind of like weird kind of combination. But it was, they brought us out there. I wanted to do new wave. I wanted to be Depeche Mode, but all these guys wanted to do funk. And it was fun.
Right.
It was wonderful. I love that music too.
And who knows how it would have changed you as musicians anyway.
And who knows if I'd even be sitting here right now because part of that whole scene out there was an enormous heroin scene.
Right.
And the one thing I'd never done. And, you know, after a while, I would have done that too.
Yeah,
probably. You know, and, you know, I look at how many musicians from that time period and from that area that I love so much, and they're mm-hmm. gone.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's drugs, and a lot of it's depression, a lot of it's booze, and it's like, those are all my problems.
Yeah, you know what else is gone is like a sound of a scene. You know, like Seattle that had a scene, it was a sound happening because there was no internet. It was like all these people just like creating in an incubator. But now, since everything is online, there's not really a scene. There could be a little scene of people making a certain sound, but it will get discovered pretty quickly once they put it online. It doesn't seem like I've heard of a sound of a, oh, there's this New York sound happening, there's right. this Chicago sound. I haven't heard of that since early 2000s
maybe. The last thing I heard about like in that kind of thing was like emo.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, like, and that, like, from what I understand, comes from like DC, like the screamo stuff, and like the emo stuff was like, you know, a watered down version of that, or,
right,
you know, as far as I understand it, because I wasn't really part of that scene.
Yeah,
but again, scene. You know, like you said, that's the last one I ever heard of.
Yeah.
I don't know anything. Everything to me now is kind of just very poppy with some type of hip hop or a bastardization of hip hop
mm-hmm.
put in.
Right.
And it just seems that way. Anything from, you know, from Taylor Swift on down, you know, I mean, that's it just seems to be that old, that generic kind of pop sound that even pop music back then, like when we were kids, had a different yeah. vibes to it.
Yeah. But there
and
was always like
the
a
same.
Yeah, there was always a cultural sort of sound happening. You know, in the 60s, everything was kind of flowery, and
right.
then it kind of morphed into something else. But I mean, now it's just what it is, and we might not relate to it as much because we come from a place of actual musical instruments.
That is true too, but I also come from a place of like you know. Like I said, you know, I want to be Depeche Mode. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I love synth bands. I love that kind of stuff because I was a keyboardist and I love that kind of thing. So it's like, I can listen to like really old Texas blues, you know, or I can listen to Skinny Puppy,
right.
you know, which is those two things couldn't be any more farther
yeah.
apart, but, or like Kraftwerk, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that there's a lot to that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if bands are going in and recording those kinds of things. I think singers are recording over pre-recorded tracks,
right?
And they don't even know the musicians that are in the room. They wouldn't care as
right.
long as there's a beat to it and there's a sound to it. They can sing over that. I don't know if anyone's really, you know, getting into like, you know, I have to have this drummer on that or that bass player and this. You know, it's just like, what's the track? Okay, I'll sing now.
Right. It's not a band with a organic interplay of sounds and
right. I don't think that exists, but I haven't been in a studio in ages, so mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure everything exists still. It
right.
might not be mainstream, mm-hmm. but.
Right.
That's
I mean, and then there's like always like, you know, like retro throwback stuff, which is done in modern ways. I mean, one of my favorite, you know, recreation bands is Orange Alabaster Mushroom. I don't know if you ever listened to them.
What are they called?
The Orange Alabaster Mushroom.
Uh-huh.
And it's a really like kind of like a Nine Inch Nails thing. It's a one man band out of Canada. And he was doing this about 15, 16 years ago, but it sounds like 1968 Pink Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally perfect 60s psychedelia, only it was recorded, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. I listen to that all the time. I love it.
Yeah.
Love it,
there's you know? Probably so much music out there mm-hmm. that we haven't even discovered.
Yeah. Yeah. I suggest everyone go out and get and check out Orange Alabaster Mushroom. It's awesome. But my favorite quote was when it comes to music like this, mm-hmm. Lemmy said it, you know, mm-hmm. and he's no longer with us too. But Lemmy, someone asked him, you know, what's the, you know, you're a hard rock musician. What's the best music in the world? And he said, whatever you were listening to when you were 18, that's the best music in the world.
Right, because it's formative, kind of helps you with your identity.
Right, and also it's just, there's no way to answer that. You know, what's the best music? I don't know.
Right.
What was the best music when you were just out of high school?
Right.
You'll always think that's the best no matter what I say.
Well, what's the yardstick for best music anyway? Right,
exactly. Yeah. It's like, there's poorly recorded music. Mm-hmm. There's poorly sung music.
Yeah.
But, you know, my painting teacher I mentioned before, he said, listen, there are no bad ideas. There's a shitload of bad paintings.
Right.
But there are no bad ideas, you know.
There's got to be bad ideas.
You know, there are unfortunate ideas. Like, like in life decision, there are bad ideas, but creatively, probably not. But, but you know, maybe there are. Maybe I could think of one or two I've had. So,
So it's the end of your 20s, and you're starting to realize, all right, this band thing might not be happening.
Oh yeah, I realized right away. I did one thing in the 90s, which was great. A friend of mine, Tom McBride, he created this off-Broadway play called The Shadow Trilogy. He was trying to bring like the Twilight Zone to live theater.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me to do the score for it, and I scored the entire play.
Wow.
And this was going back so a while ago. We didn't have the means to record to CDs. So we had a series of cassette tapes that would trigger at certain times during the play. It was cool as hell.
Yeah.
You know? I was interning at a TV talk show at the time. So I was doing that, and then I was going to these rehearsals, and I was coming home and recording. And then in the morning, going to my internship, then going to the rehearsals and coming back. And and it was fun. And it was like the last like thing I really recorded of my own music.
And it was a whole new creative outlet for you.
I'd never done that before, and I'd never done it again.
Uh-huh.
It was really, really cool.
How come you never did it again?
I never had the opportunity, really, but I just also didn't have the drive. Like, I'm sure that I could have got, if I really wanted to, I could have gone out and done that.
Right.
And I just didn't take.
So what year are we in when you're at the end of your 20s?
We're about to hit like 99. I had a job. It was very strange. I had it for 10 years, from 89 to 99. Either part-time or full-time, watching television for a living.
This is like a dream job for many people.
It was pretty trippy. It was a place called Audio Video Reporting. We would watch the news all day long and summarize what they said. And if someone was mentioned, we had salespeople going out and selling videotape copies of it to all their PR firms. Everything you can do with a Google search today, we were doing live.
Wow.
And Google came along and destroyed the entire industry.
Right, right.
So I did that job for 10 years. And then after that, I was looking for a job. And a family friend of mine, this guy, Emil Denworth, he was a Marist brother. He was the principal of St. Agnes Boys High School in the Upper West Side.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, listen, I have a new finance director, and she doesn't know how to use a computer. I heard that you lost your job. And I said, yeah. He said, well, why don't you come in and teach at the computer, and you can work for like 2 weeks, and I'll pay you $10 an hour off the books.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned into a month, turned into 2 months. And by that January, she had quit, and he gave me her job.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the finance director of an all-boys Catholic high school for the next 7 years.
Uh-huh. Now, this is probably not in your dream.
No, not in my dream at all. And that was when I started saying, okay, I'm 31 now, I'm 30, mm-hmm. 31. And I'm like, okay, all the creative outlets in my life didn't work out. Here's an accounting job.
Right.
That's allowing me to learn accounting while I'm being an accountant.
Which is like usually the example used for like when you give up.
Yes.
Just get that accounting job.
You just become a bookkeeper, damn it.
Right.
And I said, okay, I really have to start thinking about being an adult and growing up, and I have to stop all this nonsense.
Yeah.
And it was very bizarre because these are the same brothers who I had in high school. So some of my old teachers wound up on my payroll. That was really bizarre. And some of the brothers used to like scream at me and stuff. Like, I'm having business meetings with them. It's like, this is, the hell happened to me?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm in a suit and tie every day.
Yeah.
You know, and I did that for 7 years.
And what happened? Did you see yourself in the mirror one day and was like, what am I doing?
I was drinking a lot even there. I was eating terribly. I was gaining a lot of weight. I think I hit almost 250 pounds at one point. I was miserable.
Now, why do you think you're drinking a lot? Because obviously it doesn't come with the job, like being a roadie.
It doesn't, but you'd be surprised how much, and the teachers of America are going to hate me for this, you'd be surprised how much you have to lubricate teachers to keep them cool. Because they're also dealing with a lot of kids and a lot of pressure all year long, right. You know? I give people say, like, you know, well, teachers get the whole summer off, and they, you know, it's like, you know, I also think teachers shouldn't bitch about that when they have to go back, but at the same time, I get why you need that time off, you know? It's like that February break we always got in school,
yeah.
They used to call it Energy Conservation Week. It has nothing to do with that. It was, we don't want to have a lawsuit, so we have to give a week away from all these kids, for these teachers.
Yeah.
And let them go out and blow off some steam, you know. There were crazy things that went on there, and two times I actually had to take money out of petty cash to go and you know, get some teachers very well liquored up and talk them out of suing the school. So it's, you know, because these older brothers, they say stupid things. Mm-hmm. They don't know, you know, like, why it's inappropriate. You know, they lived in seminaries all their lives, and now they're dealing with young women, female teachers, and they're not meaning to be insulting, but they do, because they just are ignorant to it.
They don't have the social skills.
They don't have the social skills around it, and they'll say things thinking that it's perfectly normal, but it's like, no, that's really, really not cool.
Right.
So I used to have to sit down and talk to people and say, listen, you know, please understand where this comes from, and you do what you want, but... You know, and that was a weird part. But some of the young men that we saw through there, I mean, these amazing kids, just amazing, amazing kids.
Was that
nothing?
Was that the rewarding part of the job?
Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Hell yeah. That's I will never deny the whole warm fuzzies from helping these kids who were, you know, they were all from Upper Manhattan and from the South Bronx.
Now, do you think you were drinking because you were just kind of unhappy? Like, were you drinking to escape?
My drinking problems all come from undiagnosed and undealt with clinical depression.
Okay.
All of it. I've been clinically depressed since I was a child, and it was just in the 70s, it was just, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and stop complaining.
Right,
why are you sad all the time? And shut up. And, you know, that was the mentality. And I don't even blame my parents. They didn't know. They were ignorant to it.
They didn't have Google.
they didn't have Google, which came and destroyed my job. No, what I was doing, and what I've always been doing, is just constantly numbing my depression with alcohol. I don't have a physical addiction to it, a physical addiction to other things, and a physical addiction to tobacco instantly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't, I haven't had a cigarette in 25 years, and I can't even have a drag. If I have a drag, I'll be smoking a pack a week by the end of the next week.
Uh-huh.
It's that bad. The physical addiction was horrible.
What about if you get some secondhand smoke to you?
I have flashbacks. I have memories flash in front of my eyes of, like, living down on Rockaway Beach and smoking all the time and drinking and all that kind of stuff.
So the smoking and drinking are linked?
Badly. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you smell a beer or some bourbon or something?
That doesn't bother me, because it's not so much of a physical thing. You know, the mental thing is, I would love to go out and have a couple of beers every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really would. But, you know, I miss Guinness, you know. But I'm going on 3 years sober.
Totally sober.
You know, not even a drop. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Alcohol for medicinal uses. Some of my like allergy medications and things like that, they're alcohol based.
Oh, right.
But it's like dropperfuls in water. I mean, it's, you know, it's not throwing back shots of, you know, sure, it's medicine.
You know? It's not shot, stab.
Yeah, shot, stab. No. Although that's the end result that would happen. But it's funny when I'm at some of my jobs, you know, they say, hey, let's go get some beers. And I'm like, listen, you will thank me right now for, you know, I'm making the world a safer place if I'm not drinking. So you know.
Only 3 years, though. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, that's not that long.
No. But going on three, about 2 3/4. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
You know,
AA, all that stuff.
No, I haven't done any of that. Uh-huh. Because I recognize what the problem was.
Right.
You know, I say, okay, this is what I am doing. Right. I know what I am doing now. You know, I mean,
self-medicating.
I've been self-medicating since I was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just not good. Mm-hmm. That doesn't help anyone. You know,
cures the symptoms, not the cause.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, that whole thing. You know, sorrows float. Uh-huh. You know, and it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
But that kind of that stuff. Yeah. I mean, you know, AA isn't something I need to be reminded of. It's not, I don't need a sponsor. I don't need reinforcements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have my wife, I look at her and I'm just like, does she want to put up with that?
Right.
You know, that's my sponsor.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, okay, does she need this in her life? She certainly, most certainly does not need this in her life. So,
you know. Was she drinking with you? I'm sure you must have been.
When we first met, we used to put him back like crazy. We were the best man maid of honor at our cousin's wedding. And in the Rolls Royce with them going from the church to the reception. And we drank a bottle of champagne. And we had, you know, I had an entire cooler of Guinness waiting because I didn't want to have bad beer.
Wow.
You know, and I had actually organized that with two of the other, the groomsmen, who also wanted to have good beer. I mean, we literally had like 80 cans of Guinness waiting for us at this wedding. It was nuts. There was no point to it. But
so did you substitute the alcohol with something else?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. Not yet. At least I don't think I have.
Mm-hmm. But maybe you have. Maybe... your creative output has gone way up, I would imagine.
It really has. And the writer's blocks that I used to have are gone.
Uh-huh.
This length of sobriety, it also lets me remember certain things. Not like bad things, like good things. Like where I went with my dad one time, or things I haven't thought about in 30 years.
Right.
You know, like things I haven't thought about since I started drinking. It's like all of a sudden they're surfacing. And it's like, whoa, I remember this. And my grandmother told me that. And, you know, these little memories. And that's kind of cool. And I can take things like that and pull from them. Mm-hmm. And however many memories you have and whatever you can do, you'll always be able to pull into your stories. If you're going to be writing about certain things, it doesn't even matter if it matches up right. You can use different pieces of it and put that in there.
Yeah. You know? Have you heard that? I've always heard people that have written their own books say that everyone should write their own story. That it's such a task of self-reflection and stuff, like you're saying, stuff comes up, more memories come up, and then you're forced to talk to people in your past about your past.
Right.
And that it's just a very therapeutic kind of thing.
I think that would be fantastic. I think it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I never really thought to do it until I met Frank McCourt. And he's the author of Angela's Ashes.
Okay.
And I met him at a reading. And it's really funny. We wound up in the same bar afterwards, and I couldn't get to him.
Were you drinking at the time?
I was drinking at the time still. Yeah. And he came out and I said, "Mr. McCord, I just met you at the reading. I wanted to, you know, say hello. I wanted to have a drink with you." And he's like, "Oh, you couldn't get through?" And I said, "No." And he goes, "Oh, well, it's a finer group of people back there." You know, and he's a funny, funny guy, but he went through hell. I mean, I don't know if you ever read the book, but I mean, like the story is him and his family surviving like pretty much a secondary famine in Ireland during the Depression.
Uh-huh.
And how his father's drinking put him into abject poverty. Like, he had money for booze, but you know, his brothers and sisters were literally dying in the house because they had no food.
Wow.
You know, that kind of horror story. And he was an inspiration because he was a teacher at Stuyvesant. Mm-hmm. And people said, you know, you should write all this down, Frank. You should just write all this down. And he created this memoir. And they said, well, you know, why'd you call it a memoir? And he said, well, this is how I remember it. He said, I don't really know if it was exactly how it happened, but this is how I remember it. Right. So this is my remembrance of that. And when he said that, I went, oh, that's amazing. Yeah, I never thought of it in those terms.
Yeah.
You know? And then a couple of years later, his brother Malachi wrote his version. And it's even worse, like in a lot of ways. He's like, Frank was being nice, you know?
Interesting. So you can read both versions.
Oh, it's amazing. Like the perspective of these men.
Yeah.
Just the absolute perspective, you know? And they weren't like fighting about it. It was just, you know, this is what I remember now.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing what the brain blocks out just to cope. You know, even if I'm sure you've been here, even if you're like super drunk and you somehow manage to make it home, you've gotten your keys out of your pocket, you've put them in the door, and your brain is operating and it's seeing things, it's noticing all this stuff, but then it's not in your conscious mind. And I imagine when you're saying that you sobered up, that all this stuff came back to you.
Yeah. I was, colors look different. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
Things just seem more real, more concrete,
mm-hmm.
and less like in a dream state. Mm-hmm. I just always thought that was being creative. You know, it's like, no, it's just like I was pickled. You know? It's like, that wasn't creative. That was just, you're an ass.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But after a while, when it's all out of your head and you're not looking to get more, then it's fascinating.
looking to get more booze.
Or whatever.
Because that's not occupying your brain and like craving, that constant craving.
Right. Like I've never craved alcohol, you know, but I have craved that numbness. You know, that, like my father was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and his thing was Valium and Johnny Walker Red Label.
Ooh, not a good combination. Actually, lethal.
A horrible combination and I know that he used to have just enough to function because he was physically addicted to it.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, let alone the mental state of it all. And that's the Irish curse. I mean, that really is, you know, it's like Irish curse isn't like, you know, a little wanker. The Irish curse is this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, where it's celebrated and all the music and everything else, it's just celebrated.
Right.
And it's like, we shouldn't be celebrating this. Like, we can have a laugh about it, but we shouldn't be celebrating this. We can be, you know, our culture doesn't depend on the drugs.
Right.
You know, Colombian culture doesn't depend on, you know, the coca leaf. You know, it's a rich culture without that.
Yeah. So how do you change? You got to rebrand the culture.
I think so. One of the things it's funny. I thought about this even when I was in high school. And one of the things I tried to do at later in life, even when I was drinking, I never drank on St. Patty's Day. I just refused. And I'm like, I'm not going to be that.
Out of respect to your Irish heritage.
Yeah, it's like don't, because I'm expected to do it.
Right.
You know, it's like, why aren't you going out to St. Patty's Day? What kind of Irishman are you? I said, I don't know, a real one.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
That kind of thing would drive me crazy. But now I don't have to worry about it at all because I'm not doing it in the least.
Right. Know? And when you say you never really craved alcohol.
Right.
I was like, yeah, because you don't have to crave it for that long because it's everywhere.
There is that. I have several bottles of booze in my house right now.
If we wanted booze, we can go downstairs and we could have booze within 3 minutes.
I was buying from stores by the time I was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting in bars. One of my favorite things to tell people, that especially younger people, don't believe that you did this. I was living down at Rockaway Beach. And a block right across the street from like the old Playland that used to be there, right? This is the summer after my father died. I was 15 years old. And my friend's dads, who were all the same age, all grew up in the same neighborhoods with him, they'd bring me, you know, they'd say, hey, come have a drink with us. And they'd bring me to the bar. I'd leave the beach. I wouldn't even have shoes on.
Right.
Right? And I'd wander into these bars, these old Irish bars. Everyone's smoking, you know. I'm the youngest guy in there. And the bartenders would be like, oh, you're Paddy Devaney's son. Yeah, I owe your father a drink. Here, take this. I'm 15 years old, getting hammered, you know, in places where I shouldn't be at all. But that was just what was done. And that entire summer, I drank for free because everyone owed my father a drink. So I go to Howley's, O'Gara's, Cuckoo's Nest. Didn't matter. I go to all these different places, and they're like, "Oh, you're that guy. Okay, come here."
How did you process that as a kid watching your father drink himself to death?
That sucked. Uh-huh. That really sucked. My dad actually died of cancer. Mm-hmm. Summer of 83, he vanished for like 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And when we finally found out what happened, he had been mugged and he wound up in some alley and beaten half to death.
Wow.
And sick as, you know, just, you know, and he wound up in a hospital. The whole story of the Good Samaritan, some guy carried him to a hospital. My father was my height. He was 6 feet tall. He was 280 pounds. So this is not an easy thing to carry.
Right.
You know, he's a dead weight of that, you know? And he said, listen, I got to stop this. I have to stop drinking. I have to stop all of this. And he went to AA and he got sober.
Mm.
And a couple of months later, he started feeling really sick. Damn. And by that Christmas, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer and he died the following April.
Damn.
So he finally got his shit together. Mm-hmm. He finally got together.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, by the way, you're gonna die. You know, and that sucked.
That really sucked. Tragic.
Yeah, I was a sophomore in high school. That really sucked.
Yeah.
You know, I had learned some grace from that. One of my best friends in the world, Chris Murphy, his dad had died 2 years previous when we were in the eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like larger than life. He was like a World War II vet. He was a cop. He was a fireman. He was a state trooper. And he was the lieutenant at our local firehouse. And he died of cancer. And that Christmas time he died. And that was rough. That was really, really rough. And I remember how that felt. And then 2 years later, I was going through that. You know,
was your friend a help to you?
It was watching that, and then, you know, And it was kind of weird because then like, you know, it was on the morning of my 30th birthday, mm-hmm. I was a pallbearer for his mom's funeral. Mm. So that was, you know, so a whole lot of this kind of thing, like it's perspective,
yeah,
you know, real strong perspective. And I know people, you know, in their 40s and 50s who've never lost anyone, right. And they won't know how to function.
Right.
You know, it's like, I've been going to funerals since I was three.
Right.
So it's like, okay, well, this is, you know, learning that is really tough, you know, and like, but seeing that example of my friend and his family, like, okay, well, you know, this can happen. This mm-hmm. is real now. So then it happened to me. I'm like, okay, I understand this. This is real now.
Yeah. I mean, as Americans, I feel like we don't deal with death very much.
We don't. And we don't do it with the right way.
Yeah.
We
pretend it doesn't exist.
And we shouldn't talk about it, you
right.
know, like the way people will whisper the word cancer. You know, they'll
right.
say, and then he had meningitis. You know, it's like that's, we're so afraid of it. But you know, it shouldn't be celebrated, but it shouldn't be hidden either. You
right.
know, people's lives should be celebrated.
Right.
You know, I mean, when I go, I don't want anyone talking about any kind of morbid stuff or I miss him or that. You know, tell stories. You know,
for me, accepting my impending death helps me celebrate my life.
Absolutely,
helps me appreciate it.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's the only. Otherwise, you're dreading it. You're dreading every moment. And you're afraid to do things.
Yeah.
You know, and I know people who are terrified to do anything.
Yeah.
And why would you want to live through that? Why yeah. would you want to be that?
And they're forgetting that this doesn't last forever.
Nope. Yeah. It certainly doesn't.
Yeah.
And all the planning that you'll have for the future and all the things in the future, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, it's good to have a plan. It's good to be smart about things. You got to live now. You have to live for today, and you have to, you know, the people who matter,
mm-hmm.
you have to be able to tell them, you know, this is important.
Right.
You know, what we're doing here is important. Who we are to each other is important.
Which is more reason to be sober for it.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. You know, and there's, the other component is also, you know, what if something happened to my wife or my mom or mm-hmm. someone I cared about and I'm too drunk to drive somewhere?
Right.
You know, because I know a lot of parents that are like, listen, I'd love to have a couple of drinks. What if my kid falls off the swing?
Right.
What do I do?
Yeah.
I can't help my child because I'm on my fifth bourbon.
You're always on call.
You're always on call.
Yeah.
You know, so for the rest of my life, I'm going to be on call for one way or another. You know, for the rest of my mom's life, I'm on call there, and my wife, I'm on call there. And,
yeah.
And that's just, it just, for me, the party's over. It's like, it's for me personally, it's a smarter way to live.
Right.
You know, everyone has a different situation, but it's just a smarter way to live for me.
Yeah. Well, maybe the party's changed. Where, I mean, now you're getting a lot more rewards. You're remembering all these details, and that's going into your writing.
Yep.
And you've got all these roles. You've got a couple. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of projects in the can coming out, right?
I have a bunch. I'm so fortunate in that. And if I you bring up a good point. If I didn't control this years ago,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd have half of this ready.
I don't think
I'd have half of this done. You know, and no one wants someone falling down on their set.
Yeah.
No one wants that.
And what I was thinking earlier is that maybe you've substituted, you were self-medicating with the alcohol, and maybe you've substituted all these creative outputs. I mean, all writing a screenplay is kind of gets you juiced. You know, when the
Absolutely.
Creativity is flowing, you get juiced. It's a great drug.
Yeah, it really is, and the kind of thing, like when you're, you know, it's 5:30 in the morning, and you're hearing birds, and you're like, why are birds chirping? It's like, mm-hmm. oh, that's right, you know, it's their world, you know,
right.
like they're waking up and they're actually going to their jobs. It's like, I've been writing all night,
yeah,
and that's a great feeling.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. If I lose sleep over that, that's fine. I don't know, I'll never care about that. And it is a wonderful kind of outlet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a good point. I probably have been doing more of that. To I guess, you know, fill that void,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. When one door closes, another one opens because it has to.
Yeah, because it pretty much has to.
Yeah.
Or else you're stuck in that damn room for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So as far as when you're writing,
mm-hmm.
do you, because sometimes I imagine you get into a flow and then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, it's 5:30 in the morning. What happens mm-hmm. if you sit down to write and it's just, it's nothing's happening?
I can't sit down to write. I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I try to do something with it every day, but sometimes all that comes out is a list of things that I should be writing about when I can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing. Sometimes an idea will come to me and I'll write it down on pieces of paper all over the place. And that's my writing for the day.
Yeah.
But to sit down and, like, you know, now be creative.
Right.
You know, it's so hard to do that. Sometimes I can.
Yeah.
Some people can do that. I mean, Stephen King says he writes, sits down at the same time every day and writes 2 hours. And I believe that.
Right.
Because the man has 55 books out, and it's the craziest things I've ever read in my life.
Yeah.
And brilliant stuff. And
now, are there any tools? Because you might not feel creative, but the act of sitting down and writing will just start to get that creative juice flowing.
I don't really know. I have a hard time sitting down and just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes how I'll do it is I'll just start talking the character's lines out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll sit on one side of the room or on the other, pretending like I'm having a conversation between the two of them.
Yeah.
We recently did a film festival that my regular director of photography, Mark Boutros, he runs this thing called First Contact. It's a tiny little festival in New Jersey. And it's in this beautiful, it's like self-made theater that this guy Art Benito created on his campground. Beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
And we run this small film festival, all weird stuff, every year. And what I did last year was, this past May, I got there the night before, and then I booked the hotel room for the next 5 days, and I just hung out there and wrote.
Nice.
And what I came up with was you know, two short scripts and about 40 pages into my second feature.
Mm-hmm. Do you find there's something to taking yourself out of your routine?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm an only child who lived alone.
Mm-hmm.
I crave solitude, and I crave not being around other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to do when you live with someone.
Yeah.
You know, you can't ask them, oh, by the way, can you make yourself scarce for a couple of, you know, yeah. for a day or two? It's like, you know, hi, honey, this is your home. Can you leave? It's like, you
right.
can't do that. That's unrealistic.
Yeah.
But I still need that.
Right.
You know, and it's very difficult sometimes. But just breaking out of your pattern and isolating yourself and doing that kind of thing. I mean, there's a reason they have writers' retreats and writers' workshops that are right. in the mountains someplace. I mean, there's, you know, and this one hotel I found was fantastic. It was very quiet. It was up in the mountains in Mount Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
And they had coffee 24 hours a day. And there was nobody in the hotel. It was very, very quiet. And I had a blast. You know, I was at 4 in the morning, walking downstairs, getting hot chocolate, walking back upstairs, and falling asleep at 9 a.m., waking up at 2 in the afternoon, and doing it all again.
Yeah, it's sad. We kind of, besides the alone, getting alone time, we get desensitized to our environment, where it's harder to become creative sometimes.
You're absolutely right.
And maybe there's some tools to kick that, but I don't have them right now.
Right.
Besides, like, going somewhere new. You know, even if it's to a coffee shop and writing or somewhere else, or taking a little trip like you did and renting a room,
it's sometimes it's needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you don't go away, you know, even if it's just a change, even just go to another room in your house.
Right.
I mean, if you can't afford to do anything else, I mean, I could do a trip like that like once a year. You know, I can't afford to go into a hotel for a month. You know, it's like
right.
I could do that. I could do a week once a year.
Yeah.
But even if you can't, just if you have someone you can stay with, stay in their guest room for a day or two, you know,
right. Cat sitting, dog sitting.
Exactly. You know, be that New York schmuck and go and write your screenplay in Starbucks. I mean, I have been that guy. I still continue to be that guy.
Yeah.
You know, watching all the other idiots writing their screenplays.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Go to Los Angeles. They're all over.
Oh, I couldn't even imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Fish out of water. I've been to LAX once. I've never even stepped outside of the airport.
Oh yeah,
I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I lived there for 4 years, and it's different now that there's Uber. When I was there, there wasn't Uber, so it changed. That has changed a lot. But You've got all these screenwriters driving Ubers with their scripts in the passenger seat, waiting for the big director to come in their Uber.
Right. And maybe, you know, one of them is going to actually pull that off. More power to them.
I wonder.
You know, that would be some. Here's some unsolicited crap for you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure.
I'll get right on that, Mr. Spielberg. Thank you.
Another exercise is just sitting down and writing in someone else's voice. Which I've done, you know, like, all right, Woody Allen has a strong voice, so I'm trying to write in his voice. And you're like, oh, that's like a Woody Allen, those sort of thing, just to get the wheels greased.
I've done that. I've tried to write like Doug Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I've tried to write in that, and that's a lofty goal because he was a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
So all I can do is an approximation of how he might put things.
Right.
You know.
Does that help you get started sometimes?
It has. It has. I have a little practice story that I've been writing. I've been trying to write it as if I was his ghostwriter. It's, you know, all about space travel and the horrible things that can happen to you once you try to break the light barrier and all this, you know, all this silly stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, trying to do that. I have done it. I've only ever done it trying to do him though.
Mm-hmm. So you getting sober and getting all this renewed creativity, what happened to your painting and sculpting?
I haven't painted in a long time. I haven't done woodwork in a long time. I haven't sculpted in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing some really disturbing sculptures for a while. One time, and I still have some of these pieces. There was a dentist that had lived. His office was in the first floor of my mother's apartment building, and he moved, and he threw away all the molds of people's teeth that he has kept since the early 70s.
Oh, did you find these molds?
I called my ex up at the time, my girlfriend at the time. I said, "Listen, you got to come over. You got to bring the car and help me." Right? She's like, "Why?" I said, "I have 400 sets of human teeth,
God.
The molds.
Yeah,
we have to get these." So I brought them to a local bar, and I'm so damn hammered. We set them up over the bar. There's all these like teeth just like grinning at people. It wasn't even Halloween; it was just fun.
Right.
So I made these huge sculptures of these like this thing like screaming, and all the mouths are all open and then I made one, you know, this huge crucifix one. I mean, the thing's 4 feet tall. It's all these mouths and tongues sticking out. And,
yeah.
It's just like this, like, you know, big flesh golem thing. It's horrible.
Are a lot of your screenplays horror sci-fi?
Most of the new ones are now are sci-fi. I used to write exclusively horror, but I think that there are people who are doing better horror. Partners of mine that I've done with a million things, Lindsay Serrano and Manny Serrano.
Mm-hmm.
They have a company called Masgrave Pictures, and they do horror really well. Mm-hmm. They do it intelligently, and now they're doing like horror comedy. They're doing fun stuff,
right?
But they're better at it. They live and breathe it.
Yeah.
So I like to say, you know, listen, you know what, you guys, you're going to be making these films. You guys go for it. I don't know anyone else that's writing sci-fi, especially like science fantasy stuff, like the really off the wall sci-fi stuff. You know, Identity Check, the thing we're filming in November. It's the straightest script I've ever written in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even that has a lot of sci-fi elements to it. And it's going to be a very weird kind of thing.
Can you mix a horror sci-fi kind of thing?
Oh, I'd love to. I think it's done all the time. I mean, there's no better example than Alien.
Right.
I mean, that's pure sci-fi and pure horror and just, you know, in the hands of a genius.
What about comedy sci-fi?
I've liked it, like things like Galaxy Quest and stuff like that. It can be fun.
Mm-hmm.
More comedic elements of Star Trek and things like that.
Where Spaceballs, Mel Brooks, that's a little too far on the comedy.
I've never considered that a sci-fi film.
Yeah.
I've always considered that a parody.
Yeah.
But again, in the hands of a genius, you know, Mel Brooks is, how do you, I mean, when I see the producers, all I have to hear is the first note of Springtime for Hitler.
Uh-huh.
I start to laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, the people are just coming and sitting down into the seats, and I'm doing it now.
Right.
And you just know what's happening, what's about to happen on that stage.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. You know, that was one of my parents' first dates when they had first got married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they dated for 6 years and then they got married. And that was one of their first movie dates seeing the producers.
Yeah.
You know, when it first came out. Like, how cool is that?
Pretty cool. Test each other's sense of humor right off the bat.
pretty much, yeah. But that's that kind of stuff. But yeah, horror, sci-fi, the combinations of those, comedy is so hard to write.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see someone doing it right, I like to see more from them. Like, mm-hmm. like, listen, you got this. Keep doing it.
It's hard to write.
Timing is so difficult. I mean, you're a comedian. You know this.
Yeah.
Comedic timing is almost impossible to teach. You have to know it. You don't.
Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't translate onto the page. Like, I've read Seinfeld scripts just to kind of dissect it.
Right.
And I love the show. And sometimes, unless you know the characters, it really doesn't translate to the page. You just right. like, it just sounds like an ordinary conversation. But
right.
then you're like, you see it acted out and you're like, oh, I get it. It's the inflection of which it's spoken. And that's the sarcasm or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. It's, that's the trick of writing.
It is. And also know your characters, you know, right. and be able to convey that properly.
When you're writing, are you seeing the person? Do you have a good visual image of what they look like?
I'm seeing the character. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing how they move. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing their voice.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's specific, though, that can change. I rarely write gender specific or racial specific.
Mm-hmm.
I think that characters are most, unless you're looking for a specific type for a specific reason.
Right.
I think characters are best made as templates, and then have people read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and have the best person that pulls it off.
Yeah.
They're the character. Even if they're not what you envisioned,
right.
let them run with it.
And that's very gratifying, watching someone read what you wrote.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait for the first rehearsals for Identity Check.
Yeah.
I can't wait because the people I have, the four main characters are Lauren Biasi, Mark Abbott, who was my lead in Impervia,
mm-hmm.
Matthew J. Kaplan, who was my director in It's Time for Tea,
mm-hmm.
and as a very good actor in his own right, and mm-hmm. and a wonderful actress that I love being around and working with, named Heather Drew.
Yeah.
And she's phenomenal. And every time she and I have tried to get something going, it either couldn't be produced, or it was partially produced. And this was we're finally gonna have a chance. I'm gonna find another chance to direct her in something.
Right.
And they're the two women are the two lawyers, and Matt and Mark are gonna be the two billionaires.
You ever
fighting
have,
in this?
You ever have someone read one of your parts that you wrote and take it in a totally different direction that you didn't intend? And then it's you're like, oh, that's good. I didn't see that point of view, that angle. And then you kind of rewrite it with that new angle.
All the time.
Really? Okay.
All the time. And I've also seen directors say, no, it's this way.
Right.
And I think that they sell themselves short. I mm-hmm. think that it's a foolish, foolish thing to say, well, I wrote it this way and it's going to be this way. It's like, no, dude, no. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Let you know, your actors aren't robots.
Right.
You know, even if they're playing robots, they're not robots.
Right.
Let them, you know, here's the guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Perform this. You know what you're doing. If you trust your actors, let them perform it.
Yeah.
And if they give you something you didn't intend and it's better than you wrote, swallow your pride and say, you got this.
And that's a gift to you. You're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have people that are doing that and consistently doing mm-hmm. that, by all means do that. You know,
yeah.
we did that with Impervia. Certain things that I wrote and Mark and Dina Demko playing the lead couple. And they took it in different ways than I really thought. And I was like, okay, I mean, some of it was spot on what I thought they would do.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went with different directions with it. And the intensity they brought to it, I thought it was going to be intense. And then I saw them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is a married couple at their last, this is the straw that's going to break this family.
Right.
And they conveyed it.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It was awesome.
Yeah. It reminds me of, as a musician, when I'd have, because I'm a songwriter, when I'd have musicians come to play on my songs, I'd always have a part written, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't tell them what it was, you know. So if I had a string player, I'd have the melody played on a MIDI keyboard, but it would be muted. I'd be like, here's the song, if you have any ideas, just go for it. Because once you tell a musician or an actor what it's supposed to be, then you've taken away what they would naturally do.
Absolutely.
So that was always my tactic, was to be like, all right, here's mm-hmm. the song, just play what you feel and let them do a bunch of takes. And then when they're out of ideas, I'd be like, that was awesome. Here's the idea I was thinking, but maybe I'll merge the two. Maybe I'll like their idea better.
Sure.
But if I did play my idea first, then it might have washed away all their ideas.
It very well may have. I'll only stop someone if it's completely not what I wanted to see.
Right.
And that happens sometimes. And it's not because of anyone's skill. It's just because of how they read something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done this in auditions. I rarely audition. I usually know who I want. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I'll just say, listen, can you just like do the lines for me? Let me see it, you know? And sometimes people will take it into an extreme that I know is not going to work, but it's genuinely what they got from it.
Right.
So then I'll say, well, why would we go this way with it? You know, how about, you know, and then I'll figure out why. I'm like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool, you know, but it's always in the realm of respect. It's always like, listen, it's not like you're wrong. It's like, why did you feel that way?
Right.
But that rarely happens like that. But, you know, seeing people bring their own thing, that's what you want. That's what you want. Right. Or else you just do it all yourself.
Right. Do you prefer an actor that has a strong vision and but is able to work with you? But do you prefer when they have a strong vision, or would you prefer an actor that's like, okay, you just tell me how you want it and I'll do it?
I really dislike when people have said, well, you know, you're the director, so direct me.
Right.
It's like, no, dude, all right. I can tell you exactly what to do.
Yeah.
Right. And then you're a parrot.
Right.
It's like, I didn't hire a parrot.
And you're not getting any buzz from it either. You know, they're not making you a better director.
Not at all. Now I'm saying, okay, now I may say, okay, when you do this line, you have to make sure you're here because the camera's going to hit the mark.
Right, I mean, right.
That's we can't fudge that.
Right.
But the way you walk over there or what you say when you do it, you know, that's got to be you. You have to, again, trust your people. And if you trust your people, you will always have something more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the most I will do really is I'll tell people, you know, maybe a little softer in this, or maybe not as intense at this part, but bring it up there. Like I'll change their mood slightly,
mm-hmm.
but in general, it's like, you know, I don't know if I've ever, I can think of one time where I just said, no, we're not doing it this way. Cause it actually made no sense for the character to do a certain action.
Right.
And it was like, yeah, but this would be great to see it. And I'm just like, yeah, but it doesn't make any sense. I mean, in 12 years of doing this, I think I can think of one time where it was like, no, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
And then that was just an idea, you know, mm-hmm. of an idea of from someone who I took, you know, 10 other ideas from and said, yes, you know, so it's like, yeah.
Right. That person's got to be
right.
Like,
it's like oh, this isn't going to work. No, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, when people can do that and they bring more out into it, mm-hmm. and that's what you want. If you're not looking for that, you're selling yourself short, you're selling them short, and ultimately you're not gonna, you know, you're not a director, you know, you're a dictator.
Right.
Who the hell wants that?
Yeah, it doesn't sound as creatively fulfilling.
No, not in the least. Sounds like pretty creepy actually, but I know people like that, you know. There are people I've met that judge their success of how many people won't speak to them after the film.
Uh-huh, right.
And it's like, what's wrong with you? It's like, you know how many friends I lost over this? And I'm just like, you shouldn't have lost any. Like, that's not your freaking goal. Like, you should have made more. Like, you know, what's wrong with you?
Right, like pushing the actors so they cry or break down.
Right, or, you know, or not respecting them. Or not, you know, it's like that kind of thing. It's like, you never have to show that kind of disrespect to someone. You never have to do that.
That's like the directing school of pimpery.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want the back of my hand, so you better do it this way. It's like, no.
I'm not your director. I'm your pimp.
Yeah, really. Exactly. No, that's that. But but people say things like that to me. I'm like, what the hell? Like big festivals, people will talk to me. And I'll meet like 7 or 8 different directors a day.
Yeah.
And like most of them are cool, and we talk about things, you know. It's like, you know, like Jeremiah Kipp, I love working with him.
Mm-hmm. He's been on the podcast.
Yeah, he's one of the most in-demand indie directors in New York City, mm-hmm. you know, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. You know, he has his own series on the ID channel. I mean, this is a great guy. But I've never seen him not be anything but completely respectful to the people I worked with. When I've worked with him, that's how he treats me.
Right.
That's how, you know, and that goes a long way, you mm-hmm. know. And those are the people that are successful. That's why he can do this for a living.
Right.
You know, the other guy's like, you know, I made a film and I'm going to turn this little short into a feature. I'm going to turn that feature into a bigger feature. And then that feature is going to have a sequel. And it's like, so you have one story and you've lost half your friends. Great.
Right.
Terrific.
Yeah. We've got a good inkling into your creativity. What is, what's the next thing to watch out for that's coming out for you?
There's a lot of different things coming up. This year is going to be a big release year.
Okay, where can people find out about this stuff?
They could just come to my Facebook page, look mm-hmm. me up, Patrick Devaney. You can just look me up there.
Mm-hmm.
You can look for me. I'm the first person with my name on IMDb if you want to see what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
We have the...
I pronounced your name incorrectly. Patrick Devaney.
That's okay. That's okay.
Devaney.
Devaney.
Devaney, yeah.
That's perfectly fine. Even my own family members can't say it right. And it depends on who you talk to, you know? Yeah. If three different people in my family spell it three different ways and say it three different ways, yeah, what am I going to do? Very soon, we are going to have our original web series, Zombie Hunter City of the Dead. We have an 11th episode that is going to be coming out very soon, hopefully within about a month or so, and hopefully sooner. And that's been 4 years in the making, and it's going to be pretty spectacular. It's going to be really good. We have a lot of people in that. The release of my my web series, Massic PD, is going to be coming out later this year, hopefully by Christmas. And you can see me in a bunch of different things, but also the release soon of It's Time for Tea, Matthew J. Kaplan's film, which is fantastic. I've seen some early cuts of it. It's just really, really cool. And I was thrilled to be a part of that, you know, and it was great. He brought me on as a producer on it halfway through. And I'm like, this is wonderful. And, you know, before we shot, he's like, listen, I want you to help me with this to this level. And it's, you know, very fulfilling film, and it's going to kill people when it comes out. People gonna love this.
Absolutely.
You know? And then we shoot Identity Check in November, and hopefully that's going to be done by the following November.
Identity Check is the one you talked about earlier. That sounds great. I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you, man. Yeah. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for talking to me.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Awesome.
It's been great.
Great.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.